America versus Jackie Don Burke. And Mr. Beard, we'll hear from you.
Good morning, Judge Jolly. May it please the court, counsel. From what was a fairly nondescript jury trial, come three questions for the court today. One, being a void for vagueness challenge that was lodged below. Secondly, whether or not the offense that was charged fails for lack of a federal nexus. And then lastly, a more generic interstate commerce challenge that may or may not be more familiar to the court. Jumping first to the void for vagueness challenge. I think that the government's brief at page 11 actually sets out what the problem is here, because at page 11, the government tells the court that regardless where exactly the statute draws the line between unlicensed gun dealer who buys and sells or a hobbyist, that it's clear that Burke fell on this side of the fell on the dealer's side, if you will. And as I was contemplating that, what I'm suggesting is that's all fine and good perhaps after the fact. But the question, of course, is what is the notice that's imparted before the fact? That is to say, what is it that allows an ordinary person to open the statute?
But isn't there a principle of law that if you're clearly within the statute, the fact that somebody else might have been a little bit confused about, you know, if they sold two guns, does that make them a dealer, doesn't save you?
Arguably.
Okay, because, I mean, this guy's like got a sign, he's got a place of business, and he's not just somebody who collected some guns and sold one or two to a friend here or there randomly.
Well, I think your observation drives me exactly to this point. The government says if the case does not bring up a First Amendment implication, that we look at what the facts are. And it is the type of facts that you're bringing up that I think are in fact dispositive, certainly are critical, because consider, first of all, this is not a situation where this court is looking down under a sufficiency standard and just picking out those facts that are most favorable to what occurred. Rather, this is a situation where you are looking at all of the facts, and you're absolutely correct. Mr. Burke did have a sign. Mr. Burke did buy and sell. Mr. Burke did, for this is my word now, advertise. Mr. Burke spoke to the ATF. Mr. Burke called the ATF. In fact, at least on one occasion when someone came in to talk about buying a gun, this isn't someone who was doing something in the shadows or in an alley or what have you. He thought and went to trial because he did not understand himself to be in the business of. So I certainly think that once the court focuses on the facts, I would urge it to look at
So if you're more blatant about violating the law, then that's some sort of defense?
Well, of course, we're not conceding that he violated the law, but if you're looking at what the facts are and he is not engaging, well, let me back this up. If he's engaging openly because he thinks he's pursuing a hobby, he was previously a licensed.
He was not surreptitiously.
Not surreptitiously, precisely.
Creating a crime.
He
was openly creating a crime.
He was openly engaging in conduct that the jury ultimately determined was a crime. But again, the question
is, seemed to me that he thought that if everybody he sold to was a Texas person, because he kept requiring these Texas driver's licenses, that he didn't need a federal license. That's a different question from whether he understood himself to be in business or not.
I'm not sure.
The fact that he's mistaken about this issue of Texas versus Oklahoma driver's licenses.
Well, I think that the fact that he may have been mistaken as to what the law was only underscores the point I'm trying to make now. It's not a model of clarity.
See, that's not the confusing part that you're arguing. You're arguing that what is confusing is, when am I in the business? When do I go from being a hobbyist, to use the government's term, to being somebody who's in the business? That doesn't have anything to do with whether we're checking Texas or Oklahoma licenses.
No, I'm simply suggesting that Mr. Burke was certainly a person of I'll say ordinary intelligence, or have no reason to think that he was not, but that the various implications of this entire legal framework are not evident when you look at the statute. Even when you look at the statutory scheme now, and it talks about what in the business is, it's not something that makes it that talks about a dividing line. Mr. Burke made the challenge, at pretrial, filed the pretrial motion raising this issue. This wasn't a situation where this was brought to the court's attention after the fact, if you will.
So how would you tighten the statute? Because you always are going to have some degree of factors or something in deciding somebody's in business or not. What is it that you would think needs to be added to make this more clear?
Well, I think that's a great question. The short answer is I don't know. I'm not in the Congress. The second answer would be that the Supreme Court, in a case that we haven't cited but will provide by way of 28J, has pointed out that it's Congress's responsibility and certainly not the courts to tighten it. Third, I might also point out that it may well be, ironically, that the Internal Revenue Service their guidance might come to bear. They have
because they're such a model of clarity.
Well, they've at least spoken, and there are any number of tests that talk about the differences between hobbies and for-profit businesses. I don't have a specific answer to you other than to say, I don't know, but it's not our responsibility, sir.
No, I'm not saying that it's your responsibility, but criticizing a statute as being vague, and I'm saying, well, what is it missing that would make it clear? Because to me, your argument is that it's vague. Why? And that's what I'm trying to get at. I agree. You don't have to write the statute for Congress, but you have to at least point us to what would make it clearer, or why is it so vague, or whatever. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Oh, and I appreciate that I do. It's beyond my expertise. I'm not in the statute writing business, but I do know when something is vague and someone doesn't know what it means. I'm in that business all of the time. I don't have a more.
Well, I mean, if you suggest you don't know how to make it any clearer, you're saying it's a crime that cannot be written by Congress. You say, I don't know how to make it any clearer. This
no.
is as clear as it can be. I'm not going to say anything further.
No, I was perhaps implicitly suggesting, hopefully, that there are brighter minds in Congress than I have, brighter minds than mine in Congress.
let's not go there.
Well, I'm all right then. But I think that your question brings up and moves me to the second point, because you're talking about whether or not something was, in fact, susceptible to being declared a crime, and that immediately focuses my attention, at least, on the second point, and that is whether or not this was, in fact, a federal crime. And we pointed out that 922A1, we think, is susceptible of being violated in two fashions. Notice that the indictment in this case looks at the statute and charges it under the first prong, if you will, of the provision. It speaks about business of dealing in being in the business of dealing in firearms. Doesn't mention any type of interstate commerce requirements. The question came up, and the government pointed out in its brief whether there was even a need where Congress have the ability to move into this area and to regulate what are intrastate dealings going on here. Because of course these guns were all bought from and sold, but obtained from a neighboring pawn shop. These did not come from other areas of the country, or at least there's no evidence that they did. He did not buy or sell them to people out of the state. And I want to respond briefly to something that the government said, because the government's relying on the Supreme Court's opinion in Raich, which of course is the California case, which had to do with California allowing medical marijuana to be cultivated. And the question became whether or not under the Controlled Substances Act, that would still constitute federal offenses, and the Supreme Court said yes, that it would, because, and this is the point I wanted to move to, because the purely intrastate activity would interfere with Congress's attempt to eradicate a national market in marijuana. That's a far different situation than what we
have. So what do you do about United States versus King? We already have precedent on this, and we've already rejected your argument, and how can we be free to do otherwise? At least we three, we're not kings, yes, but we three judges.
Sure. I think that the answer actually lies in the Raich opinion, because Justice Kennedy, writing in Raich, said that when these interstate commerce challenges come up, that they have to be determined with all of the court's other opinions in mind. King was written well before the recent, I don't want to say slew, but the recent number of interstate commerce cases that the Supreme Court has written. And so what I would ask the court, this panel, to do is to take a look at the issue in light of the subsequent opinions, because, of course, the government says there's been no change in the law. And we, in fact, think that there has.
Then what do you do with Alcantar, which basically rejected that idea that Sebelius, et cetera, the case about the Affordable Care Act and so forth, had somehow morphed over to this area of regulating guns?
Whether there's a hint of a change in the law or whether or not there was actual, in Sebelius, an indication. What I would do as I would look and say, if I were writing this opinion, I would point out that we're in 922A1 and we're not in the felon in possession statute. I do understand Alcantara's position. It came out of our office. I'm quite familiar with it. With respect to the United States, I understand their desire to run from Supreme Court opinions because those opinions haven't exactly favored the government recently on interstate commerce, but I'm not aware of any doctrine that requires this court to run from the Supreme Court.
Well, opinions. I mean, so, we have this rule of orderliness,
yes.
and reasonable minds can differ on the degree of this rule of orderliness, but as I appreciate it, we aren't free to overrule a prior panel unless there's an intervening en banc or Supreme Court case. And just the fact that the Supreme Court might have kind of waded into some area way over here that sounds like if this ever got to them, they might kind of think about doing something different than we did, that isn't really an intervening precedent as I understand it.
I appreciate everything you just said. I think that the only way then, from my perspective, then to avoid it is to look and notice that these are different statutory provisions. I don't think Alcantara necessarily applies to all of 922G. I didn't read it that way. Or, I'm sorry, 922, because we're in 922A.
Trailing off.
I'm sorry?
Your voice is kind of...
Oh, forgive me.
Off kind of into a mumble.
All right, let's see if I can stand closer to the microphone. I was suggesting that the way out of that box, to the extent you see it as a box, is to point out that we're talking about different statutory provisions than Alcantara.
But not than King.
I'm sorry?
I mean, we're back
no,
to King.
No, but we also have, but then of course we also have a number of Supreme Court opinions that I think would compel the court to look and see whether or not King was actually, is actually, well, good law.
But you would agree that these cases you're talking about are not cases about 922. They're cases about, for example, health care and so on.
They are cases about the Commerce Clause and what Congress's ability...
Well, the Commerce Clause is a huge animal, okay?
Precisely.
And so there's pieces of that, and to me, the Affordable Care Act case certainly garnered a lot of attention and excitement and interest in all of that, but it didn't purport to completely eradicate the commerce underpinning of umpty-ump federal criminal statutes.
Let me suggest perhaps another Supreme Court opinion, although it is an opinion written by just two justices, and they are in Alderson, they are writing to protest the denial of cert, and this was a case in which the very interstate commerce arguments that I'm getting ready to move to, the substantial effect and what have you, were raised. I understand the Commerce Clause is broad, but the fact that it's broad does not mean that it's boundless. And I think that when you look at the health care opinions, when you look at Alderson, when you look at Lopez, what we're seeing here, at least as I'm reading it, plainly reading it, is you're seeing attempts to bound and to do so and to articulate what the boundaries are. I think your observation is correct that at least for 80 to 90 years there has been a tendency for the Commerce Clause to reach anything, but I don't think that's the situation now. In the final 2 minutes, I wanted to point out a couple of facts about this case. If you go into the question, or you address the question of effects on interstate commerce, I would like to point out to the court what may not jump out at you when you actually look at the record. These guns were bought and sold in Texas. There were no guns that were bought and sold outside of the state. Even the reference in the government's brief to the Chinese firearm, it was bought at the local pawn shop. What struck me when I went through the record, this isn't the normal case where the ATF brings someone in, a witness in, one of their own witnesses, one of their own experts, and they testify as to where the gun came from and that it must have traveled in commerce and so on and so forth. In fact, what the government's brief says is that it's simply common knowledge that these guns came from other places. Perhaps the government runs in different circles. I don't know where any of the guns came from, and I was in the fighting business for a while. I don't think it's common knowledge. I think that they simply forgot to put on evidence. I think that if you were to look at it very narrowly, there is no evidence that the firearms in question had an effect, much less a substantial effect, even if you were to reach that question, on interstate commerce, and I do think that is a requirement. I'll surrender my last 40 seconds. I look forward to talking to you in a few moments.
Thank you. Mr. Romani. United States.
May it please the court, Andrew Romani for the United States. Mr. Burke's constitutional challenges face two insurmountable hurdles. First, both of the issues he raises are foreclosed by this court's existing precedent. And second, his Commerce Clause challenge can be reviewed by this court only for plain error, because he did not raise that issue below in any fashion whatsoever. I'll start with the Commerce Clause challenge. This court repeatedly held in the 1970s that Congress's regulation of the interstate business of dealing in firearms through the requirement of licensure was a valid exercise of his commerce authority. And those cases and cases like them recognized that Congress had a rational basis for concluding that it could prevent the interstate use of firearms for unlawful purposes only by regulating all firearm sales, including purely local sales.
What about the argument that the more recent U.S. Supreme Court cases are trying to put boundaries on the seemingly boundless Commerce Clause? What do we do with those cases?
Well, Mr. Burke relies principally, if not exclusively, on the Supreme Court's decision in National Federation. As this court held in Alcantar, National Federation, at the very most, provides only a hint about how the Supreme Court might rule on these sorts of issues in the future. And according to the court, a hint's simply not good enough to overcome the prior panel rule. So cases like King, subsequent cases from this circuit reaffirming that decision, remain binding on this panel.
Okay, so should we affirm and then write a concurrence to our own affirmance saying this case should be taken en banc so we can consider these precedents to get past this issue of orderliness?
Well, let's look at National Federation on the merits. If that case breaks new Commerce Clause ground, it does so because it recognizes that Congress cannot use its commerce authority to compel private individuals to engage in economic activity where they're not already so engaged. That's not what Section 922A1A does. It doesn't compel economic activity where it doesn't already exist. Instead, it merely regulates existing economic activity, the buying and selling of firearms, because of the impact that that conduct has on interstate commerce. National Federation doesn't undermine...
Okay, but isn't the problem that so let's put guns aside for a moment. If I sell my car to my neighbor, then my neighbor isn't going to go buy a car that traveled in interstate commerce. So I've just affected interstate commerce by a next-door neighbor transaction. Can that now be regulated by Congress? Because I'm affecting interstate commerce by sort of depriving a market for interstate commerce with my intrastate sale.
Well, maybe. I mean, you'd have to look at the facts of the statute and the totality of the conduct, but since Wirkert versus Filburn, Congress has always been able to regulate purely interstate economic activity if it has a rational basis. It's the lowest test in constitutional law for concluding that there's a substantial effect on interstate commerce. And that really gets into Lopez and Morrison, which are the two cases that have kind of drawn these limits on Congress's commerce authority. In the courts, principal concern in those cases was really twofold. First, Congress, for really the first time in its history, was using its commerce power to regulate interstate activity that was entirely non-economic. So in Lopez, it's having a gun near a school. In Morrison, it's violence against women. And if you look at those two areas of regulation, violent crime, education, those have traditionally been core functions of state government under the police power rather than the federal government. And second, the court was really concerned that the connection between the regulated interstate activity and interstate commerce was attenuated to such an extent that if the court affirmed, Congress's commerce power would be left with no meaningful limits. If Congress can regulate guns near schools because guns have the potential to impact education, and because education has the potential to impact the national economy one day, then using that sort of attenuated and inferential reasoning, it can effectively regulate anything. We don't have those concerns with respect to Section 922A1A. The statute regulates core commercial activity. It's the buying and selling of a product. That's the sort of regulation that lies at the very heart of the Commerce Clause.
So you're saying there is no need for an interstate nexus in any buy-sell transaction. If Congress chose to regulate it, they could, because all commerce affects interstate commerce, even if it's wholly, my block. We're having a garage sale on my block.
Well, I would point the court back to Lopez and Morrison. And what Lopez and Morrison says about an interstate nexus is that it's one of several factors that courts will look to in determining whether Congress had a rational basis for concluding that regulated activity fell within its commerce power. But it's by no means dispositive. Congress has always had the power to reach purely interstate activity if it has a rational basis for concluding that that has a substantial effect on interstate commerce. And if you go back to the legislative history of Section 9...
Let me ask you about the record in this case. Do you concede that all of the evidence in this case indicates that each sale of each gun was to a Texas citizen?
I don't believe that the court... I can point to evidence that shows that it was an out-of-state person. I would note that Mr. Burke was buying and selling guns on the Internet. It's a source that has no geographic boundaries. So it's very likely that he was selling guns to people out of state. And remember, we're in a...
Did he prove it? In other words, what I'm asking is whether he proved the facts upon which to base his argument.
I think the record is murky on the subject. I think in...
Who has the burden of proving interstate commerce?
Well, we would assert that we have no burden because the statute contains no interstate nexus element, and that was by congressional design. If you go back to the Senate report and the House report, they made a specific determination that firearms are a national problem, and the only way we can regulate that national problem is by regulating the source of guns, including all sources, not just interstate sources, but purely intrastate sources.
So that's your position?
That's our position. There was no requirement for us to make this showing. And remember, we're dealing in a plain error situation here. Certainly if Mr.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, plain error, obviously, any kind of error here would hardly be plain, would it?
But no,
that's a friendly question, obviously.
Understood, Judge. When you're dealing with a situation where the principal authority that Mr. Burke relies on has already been rejected and limited by this court, at least in a prior panel sort of situation like we're dealing with here, it's clear that Mr. Burke cannot show plain error.
You mean Alcantar?
Alcantar.
Already hints at how we should decide this?
Precisely, Your Honor. The government easily could have proven an interstate nexus in this case. It simply wasn't on notice that it was required, which I think brings in the plain error piece of this analysis, that even if there's arguably error, and certainly the government doesn't think that there's error here, the error certainly wasn't plain. Turning to the...
Okay, so let's talk about the vagueness. So his argument is, look, I'm sitting here in the plain light of day in Garland, Texas, selling guns out of a business with a big sign. That sure doesn't look like someone who thinks they're violating the law and they're not doing it in the shadows, et cetera, et cetera. So if we assume that Mr. Burke is a person of reasonable sensibilities and so on and so forth, how was he on notice that he was in business?
Well, two answers to that question. I think the statute clearly gives him notice, but on a factual basis, in 2006, the ATF went out to his business, issued a cease and desist order, telling him that this exact conduct required him to be licensed. And he actually, remember, this individual used to be a federally licensed firearms dealer. After losing his initial license in 1994, he tries three separate times to apply for a license, but fails to follow through. Not because he doesn't think that he's engaged in the business of dealing in firearms, but he doesn't want to deal with the administrative bureaucracy that goes along with the process. He testifies, they told him...
The jury heard all of this.
The jury heard all that. And remember, we're dealing with the vagueness challenge here. We have 12 individuals from the community who look at the definitions in the statute provided by the judge, and they have no trouble looking at these facts and saying, beyond a reasonable doubt, this individual fell on the dealing in the business of firearms side of the statute. And that's the relevant analysis.
So you're saying even if, you know, Grandma Smith, who goes around selling a gun occasionally, could be confused, that doesn't help Mr. Burke?
It doesn't help Mr. Burke, and I point the court to the Supreme Court's decision in Lawson, this court's decision in Brooks, both of which say that when you're dealing with these sorts of vagueness challenges, you have to look at the facts of the case before the court. And the facts here aren't even close. I mean, Mr. Burke clearly held himself out to the general public to be a dealer in firearms. A court's already mentioned the sign that's placed outside his business for a year. I buy, I sell, I trade firearms. He affixes much of his inventory with price tags, which is clearly conduct that is inconsistent with a collector just trading out a portion of his collection. When people come into his business, he gives them a sales pitch. He says, hey, look, buying from me is better than buying from a federally licensed dealer because you don't have to pay me sales tax. I can throw in additional items that you're not going to get from a licensed dealer. He used other hallmarks of salesmanship. He would ask individuals, hey, what's your price range? Well, this is the inventory I have available at that price point. And he was giving individuals sales receipts. I mean, that's clearly...
is this man just being very foolish? I mean, seems like he would have known he's violating, if he knew he's violating the law out in the open like that, and he's just saying, come get me. Doesn't sound like he's very rational.
That very well may be. Remember, this individual attempted to apply for a license 3 times. He doesn't follow through. He says, well, I didn't want to wait the 2 years that it took to get a license. I was having trouble obtaining the appropriate signatures. That's an effective admission by Mr. Burke that he knew well that he was engaged in the business of dealing in firearms. He simply made the deliberate choice not to follow the law. He decided to roll the dice with the jury, and the jury ultimately said, no, your intent here was to make a profit, which is the determinative factor under the statute. You weren't a mere collector. And there's other facts that support that. I mean, really, the statute focuses on intent. That's really the dividing line in the statute. Is the individual regularly buying and selling guns with a profit motive, or are they periodically buying or trading out a gun for the purposes of enhancing a collection or as a hobbyist?
Mr. Beard mentioned the notion that we should look to the tax code for help in deciding when somebody's in business. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I'm not aware of any support for that position, and I note that Congress already went back in 1986. Remember, when King, I think that's another important point here, when King was decided, engaged in the business of dealing in firearms had to be construed by someone's common sense. Now, had I been here in 1970, I think that might be a little tougher argument to say that that's not vague. But in 1986, Congress goes back and they build in specific definitions for the specific purpose of narrowing this statute. They wanted to draw a line between their interest in protecting the public from firearms in the hands of the wrong people and the interest of legitimate collectors, hunters, and so forth. So they give a specific definition of engaged in the business of dealing firearms, and they give a sub-definition of what it means to act for the principal purpose of motive or livelihood. And Mr. Burke clearly falls on the profit, motive, livelihood side of the line. He admits on cross-examination that he's selling these guns to make a profit. He explained to the jury, I buy these guns at a low price, I mark them up by $25 a piece, I very rarely lose money doing this. If the court has concerns about the collector piece of the statute, Mr. Burke was selling guns on consignment. These aren't his guns, part of his personal collection. These are other people's guns. He's taking these guns, he has contracts drafted up that says that he receives a 10% commission on guns that he sells for other people. The evidence is that shortly before the investigation began here, he sold $45,000 worth of guns at a gun show on consignment.
So is it fair to say we don't have to decide for all times whether this statute could be void for vagueness as to someone, it just isn't as to Mr. Burke?
That's exactly what...
And can you have a statute like that? I mean, I realize that's kind of what the cases say, but does that make sense that it could be vague to Grandma Smith, but not to Mr. Burke?
That's exactly what the case law says, that when you're dealing outside the First Amendment context, you're dealing with an as-applied vagueness challenge. So I'm not sure this court will ever have an opportunity to speak to the statute generally. I'm not sure it needs to. And that's confirmed by recent unpublished decisions from this court, which have looked at the new definitions, or at least relatively new in the last 20 years from Congress, and said that these aren't vague as applied to similar facts. And I think that's really where you end up. And certainly if this court has concerns about the statute, this is not the right case to try to draw those lines, because the facts here clearly fall on the side of someone that is engaged in the business of dealing in firearms. Unless there are additional questions from the court, I'm happy to concede the remainder of my time.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Romani. Beard, we'll hear from you in rebuttal.
If I don't talk about anything else, I want to talk about the review standard. Plain error does not apply here. I was quite surprised, in fact, that the government advanced this in their brief.
Well, you didn't file a reply brief.
No, we did not. And
so now you're going to...
You weren't surprised enough.
No, in fairness, I was surprised. I was confident in my ability to speak to the issue now.
Okay, well, tell us why.
All right, let's talk about this then. First of all, Mr. Burke moved for Rule 29, did so properly at the close of the government's case, and then the district court asked if he was renewing it at the close of his own case, and he said yes. He said yes.
It's and not out of the microphone. It's your problem.
Okay. And he said, and he renewed the motion. The majority rule in the circuit for decades has been that the Rule 29 preserves any number of different challenges. The government right now is asking you to carve out what we call a legal question exception, that because he did not specifically address the legal question below with regard to some of his challenges now that they're governed by plain error. I'm going to send you a list of cases. I can speak to one that I argued in this en banc courtroom, the Cuellar case, where a post-verdict judgment of acquittal motion was entered. It was sufficient to go before a panel, United States versus Cuellar, which we took judgment 2-1. The en banc court reversed us, regrettably. The Supreme Court reversed the en banc court, happily, at least from our perspective. At no time was there ever a suggestion that the motion for judgment of acquittal was somehow insufficient to address the legal question that was raised there, which was the interpretation of the statute. We're in exactly the same situation right now. If that weren't illustrative, then I'd ask the court to look at United States versus Herrera, which is the court's en banc opinion, which implies implicitly that our position is correct, that the court has plenary review. In Herrera, the court said, this en banc court said, if you move for judgment of acquittal on a specific ground, basically that's where you're left with that specific argument. Implicitly, then, if you don't move on a specific ground, you have a whole...
Wow, this is a brand new view of plain error versus plenary review for me, because the whole point is to give the judge a chance to get it right. So if your whole argument is, I mean, I understand a motion for acquittal typically raises the sufficiency of the evidence, whether you say so or not. But to say that also puts the trial court on notice that you're making this global sort of constitutional challenge, that, wow, that's news to me. I mean, it would have been helpful to file a reply brief so we could look at these cases that you think stand for such a broad proposition, and that Mr. Romani or the U.S. attorney could have had a chance to address that and not just show up on rebuttal in your argument in the Fifth Circuit to make that broad of an argument. That seems pretty overstated to me.
I certainly accept the court's criticism with regard to the reply. It's been a challenging time, and you're exactly correct. But the cases say what the cases say, and I'm confident of what they say, and what I'll do, if with the court's permission, I'll stand on my assertions as to what they say, and I'll respond to a couple of other things that Mr. Romani has said. As I hear it, he's basically writing, saying to the court that the Commerce Clause reaches everything. We can dress it up, we can do whatever, but that's what he's basically saying. Whether the government runs from it, the notion that there are bounds is one issue, whether the court does is another. But I'd ask the court to keep its eye on the ball. I, in fact, think that this is a very good case for the panel to explore some of these issues. I also thought, Judge Haynes, that your inquiry about the en banc option was intriguing. I hadn't thought about that. But at some point, I do have to ask the question, you know, rhetorically perhaps, what does all this Commerce Clause, what does this mean? This individual was not... There is no evidence that these gun transactions that may have taken place on Guns America that had anything to do with anything other than intrastate sales from the pawn shop. It's not murky. They didn't come forward and show any of these type transactions that the ATF always shows in gun cases. It's not there.
Well, isn't the internet an instrumentality of interstate commerce?
It is, but there's no evidence that the sales were that there were actual sales from there when they saw the particular internet site, but the sales that took place were from a local pawn shop. So once again, we're back to this whole intrastate scenario, the car scenario you described, what have you. I would simply re-urge the points that we've raised. My apologies with regard to the lack of reply brief. I accept the criticism. I think it's well placed. But I'm confident as to the authorities, and I'm also confident as to the arguments we've raised. Thank you very much.
All right. We call the next case.